From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. At the Conservative Political Action Conference this morning, President Donald Trump announced what he called the toughest sanctions ever on North Korea. His administration also notified Congress today that the U.S. Embassy in Israel will move to Jerusalem in May. But on gun control, the president did not mention his support this week for increasing the minimum age for owning a semi-automatic weapon to 21. Instead, he promised the CPAC audience to, quote, do something that works.
And there's nobody that loves the Second Amendment more than I do. And there's nobody that respects the NRA. They're friends of mine. They backed us all. They're great people. They're patriots. But they're great people. But we really do have to strengthen up. Really strengthen up background checks. We have to do that.
Also, there's news today that the Trump campaign official Rick Gates is expected to plead guilty in the ongoing FBI Russia investigation. That's a sign that he's cooperating with special counsel Robert Mueller as he investigates possible Trump campaign collusion with Russians. Our Friday roundtable joins us now to talk about it all today. Jesse Holland, Associated Press reporter. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Doing well. And Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And let's listen to a little bit more of the president at CPAC this morning talking about Democrats and the upcoming midterm elections.
If they get in, they will repeal your tax cuts. They will put judges in that you wouldn't believe. They'll take away your Second Amendment, which we will never allow to happen. They'll take away your Second Amendment.
Rick, the president spoke for a long time. It sounded like a lot of red meat to the base. What stuck out to you about the speech?
It was a greatest hit speech from the president. What struck me was the tone, given the timing, that we've had this national tragedy barely a week ago. You had the president in empathetic mode talking to victims of gun violence just a few days ago. And there was really no mention of that side of it. This was a chance of lock her up. There was a dig at John McCain in there. There was a lot of red meat for the base. And on gun control, as you mentioned, he did not actually talk about his support for gun restrictions. While he talked about arming teachers and securing schools and mental health, he was staying away from some of the more controversial aspects of what even he has begun to propose.
Well, Jesse, why do you think that is? Why did the president stay away from things that he's even been talking about this week on guns?
Well, we can, from the speech today, we can call it a greatest hits speech, or you can also call it a rerun, because he stuck to the things he knew that would rile the crowd up. He stuck to his applause lines. He didn't really reach very far in trying to get new ideas, new proposals out at CPAC. He stuck to what he knew would get applause from the audience he was in front of. It seems that sometimes he gets energized by cheering crowds. So he makes sure he gives them the material he knows they're going to cheer. So we didn't see anything controversial. We didn't see anything new. We didn't see anything groundbreaking out there at CPAC. But we did see a lot of applause and a lot of chants that looked like the crowds and the appearances we saw during his campaign to president.
You know, I want to play a little bit of tape from the president yesterday because there's still a question of exactly where does he stand on some of these proposals about gun legislation we've been hearing about this week. So again, this is the president yesterday. He was asked about his support for raising the minimum age for a gun purchase to 21, even though the NRA does oppose that.
I don't think I'll be going up against them. I really think the NRA wants to do what's right. I mean, they're very close to me. I'm very close to them. They're very, very great people. They love this country. They're patriots.
So, Rick, if you're a member of Congress, a Republican member of Congress who may be tasked with actually coming up with some kind of legislation, where does what the president has and hasn't been saying this week leave you?
I think they feel like because they've been away for a few days, they can let the president ponder openly whatever he'd like. And when they're back next week, they can start to get down to business. They're not going to have votes on this for a while. I think members of Congress are just going to look to see what are the policy proposals. And I think most of them are very skeptical that he is going to be up against the NRA in any way. He is aligning his views more closely to them. We know that he's talked extensively to the NRA in the last few days. His speech at CPAC today, just 24 hours after a couple of NRA members fired up the crowd there a day before. And I think that the general sense is that these things erupt and there's a big mass movement, but then they begin to fizzle and people focus on other things. The open question to my mind now, is this different? Because it does feel different. And to see the voices of these teenagers so eloquently eloquently speaking about the impact of gun violence. You've seen Senator Marco Rubio and a few others begin to say maybe we do need to reexamine gun laws. But I'm not there yet. I think we're going to have to see how far this movement lasts. It can't just be about big public discussions. It has to be about policy proposals, which we just haven't seen yet.
Yeah, it does feel different this time, I have to say. You know, having now covered so many of these mass shootings, the students have really given voice that we haven't heard as much in the past. Let's listen here to Alfonso Calderon on Wednesday when students held a rally in Tallahassee. This is a Parkland student survivor.
Everybody needs to remember, we are just children. A lot of people think that disqualifies us from even having an opinion on this sort of matter, as if maybe because we've been through a traumatic experience that we don't know what we're talking about, that we're speaking irrationally. And I want everybody to remember that is not the case.
Jesse, do you think at the end of all this that there will be some meaningful changes?
Well, it's hard to tell because we're still so close to the tragedy itself. We expect people to be loud and to be stringent about their issues directly after the tragedy. Where we'll see the difference is 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now, if we're still seeing the same amount of passion, if students are still out there protesting and pushing their parents to push their lawmakers to do something different. It's easy to push right on the heels of the tragedy. Lasting change comes weeks, months later when people are still out there. So it'll be interesting to see if this kind of enthusiasm we're seeing from the grassroots, from children in school, still exists a month or two from now when we see other issues come up. If it's still going 2 or 3 weeks from now, a month from now, we know we'll probably see something behind that.
Well, let's take a quick look at other major news today. This is from the Russia investigation. A guilty plea from former Trump campaign deputy director Rick Gates. He was first charged in October. New charges this week. Rick, what do you think?
Well, this is a big deal in the sense that we've seen more weight put on Manafort and now Gates to try to come to some kind of a conclusion. This is another top campaign official who also served in the White House and during the transition in an extensive way. So he's got ties that are actually more extensive than even Paul Manafort's. I think the general sense is that this is more pressure on Manafort to flip. Gates is going to have potentially testimony that's damaging to Manafort. Manafort, who's in his late 60s, is looking at potentially spending the rest of his life in prison now. That can get things very serious very fast. But I think the general sense of pressure building and that Mueller is tightening the noose around a number of individuals close to the president. We don't know exactly where he goes, but we know that he has been able to bring substantial evidence that's now brought guilty pleas from a former national security advisor, I mean, Michael Flynn, now a former deputy campaign manager, another campaign advisor in George Papadopoulos, in addition to the rafts of indictments that have flowed out of that office.
And at the same time, the charges we're talking about today and in the last week are pretty far removed from Trump campaign collusion with Russians trying to interfere in the election, Jesse?
Right. I believe we're only seeing the outer edges of the investigation. I think Robert Mueller is building a case, moving step by step to see where it goes. I mean, if you're inside the White House, you have to be getting a little bit worried with the guilty pleas, because that means that there won't be a trial. There won't be anything that you can spin in public. You have people admitting that they're doing these things. So we know that the more guilty pleas we see, the closer Robert Mueller's getting to what we know he really wants. And so it's just you have to start getting worried if you're inside the White House.
Well, one more thing about DACA. Of course, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Let's hear what the president had to say this morning about it, because, of course, he ordered it to end on March 5th, which is just a week from this coming Monday.
The Democrats are being totally unresponsive. They don't want to do anything about DACA, I'm telling you. And it's very possible that DACA won't happen. And it's not because of the Republicans. It's because of the Democrats. And frankly, you better elect more Republicans, folks, or it'll never happen.
Rick, is time really running out to get a solution to this?
It sure may be if the president keeps to his timeline, but that's the twisted logic there, is that it's the president's timeline. Mm-hmm. He set this deadline, not a court, not the Democrats, certainly. And if you believe his timeline, he's ready to act after March 5th to have the status expire for 800,000 DACA recipients. They could be in danger of deportation. Now, a lot of people think he'll push the deadline because it was set by him personally, but that is a strange sort of logic to pursue, that you need to elect more Republicans to protect Dreamers. Keep in mind, the president, just a few minutes after that little clip there, went on an extended riff telling a story from an old song about a snake, in which the snake actually is an immigrant. That is not the kind of attitude toward immigration that I think is similar to what he just said about the Dreamers. So that makes it an interesting moment, and you're right, only a week away.
Well, and by the way, there's a story out right now about the fact that Melania Trump's parents are being given a green card thanks to what President Trump is against, which is what he calls chain migration.
That's right. And I think that no mention of that, as the president wants to get rid of chain migration.
Jesse, just a few seconds. Go for it.
Sure. And if you know the president doesn't want this to linger through the midterm elections.
Right.
So you think that if he's setting that timeline, he wants to move sooner than later, because you know Democrats are going to be pushing this issue when it comes to the midterm elections.
That's Jesse Holland with the Associated Press, and Rick Klein of ABC News. Thanks to both of you.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, deep inside a permafrost mountain in Norway, a vault will be opened. It's called the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. It was established in 2008, and inside it live thousands of seeds from all over the world. Those seeds represent about 40% of the world's seed diversity, and 60,000 new seed samples are about to be added. It's part of an effort of the Crop Trust, an organization that helps manage a global network of food crop seeds. The seeds for plants from coconuts to coffee are a backup for the global food supply, a kind of Noah's Ark in case of natural disaster or famine. Seems like a futurist idea, but that vault actually has its roots in World War II. Ben Brock Johnson from the podcast Endless Thread discovered the story of Svalbard's precursor on Reddit.
The history of the Svalbard vault begins not in Norway, but nearby in Russia, with a man named Nikolai Vavilov. His life's work? Creating the richest seed supply the world had ever seen at the time, hidden away, underground, in its own vault, in what is now the city of St. Petersburg. Back then, it had a different name, Leningrad. And Leningrad was under siege. Okay, you know how people say so-and-so wrote the book on X? Well, agricultural ecologist, ethnobotanist, and Franciscan brother Gary Nabhan wrote the book on our Russian botanist Nikolai Vavilov.
Well, Vavilov was from a very well-educated family in Russia. I think every one of his siblings became a scientist as well.
The book is called Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine.
He grew up in a period where Russia and Eastern Europe had suffered one famine after another due to inclement weather causing crop failures.
These famines that he grew up with, how serious were they?
They were of epic proportions. From the 1860s on, there were six major famines that killed over 500,000 people in Eastern Europe and Russia.
Vavilov's upbringing around these horrendous crop failures and famines leads him to learn a ton about plants and botany. And as he is doing his work as a botanist in the 1920s, he starts to get into this idea that collecting the plants or the seeds might help fight off crop failures, because he might be able to breed the plants and find certain strains that could resist bad weather and thus famine.
There were people with their eyes on the same prize earlier on in history. Thomas Jefferson, for example, who collected seeds and brought back cuttings of plants to the Americas. But Vavilov was the first one who had the education in what we would call evolutionary biology, how plants adapt to different climates and conditions. He had sort of this humanitarian set of values that underscored the way he did science in sort of a remarkable way. I mean, he really was a superstar up there with Charles Darwin and other people that we could mention.
Vavilov is by many measures one of the world's seminal plant geneticists. But he also doesn't want any Russian, really any human, to die again because of famine. Over time, this remarkable humanitarian way of doing science gains Vavilov a lot of followers. And over his career, Vavilov does something that is pretty incredible. He and his team of scientists gather hundreds of thousands of different kinds of seeds from 64 countries. It takes over 100 different expeditions to do this. He's like Russia's Indiana Jones of seed collection. And he is super charismatic, he's handsome, he's good at raising money, but he's not without his detractors. Everybody famous has some haters, and Vavilov's got a problem. That problem's name is Trofim Lysenko. Lysenko starts out as a student of Vavilov, and Vavilov encourages him. But then Lysenko gets into this weird pseudoscience that rejects the idea of genetics. And he becomes this, like, anti-science-based agriculture guy, which is a little odd because he also becomes the head of the Academy of Agricultural Sciences. Lysenko doesn't like Vavilov. They are rivals now. And Lysenko gains the ear and the favor of Stalin. It's August of 1940. You can almost guess what happens next.
Vavilov was out on another collecting expedition in the Caucasus, found what he believed was a new subspecies of wild wheat that could be very effective because it was so drought tolerant. And as he was coming back to his vehicle, several black unmarked cars from the KGB or its predecessor showed up. Vavilov was scuttled away and disappeared from public sight.
So Vavilov is thrown into a prison in Leningrad, a.k.a. St. Petersburg. The prison is like a stone's throw from his family home. Vavilov's family members would pass by without even knowing he was right there. And his followers don't know where he is either. But they have a mission, Vavilov's mission, of preserving and studying the world's food crops, of killing hunger forever. His mission has a headquarters. It's this building at 44 Herson Street in St. Petersburg.
His staff sort of came together. They adored this man and said, we can't let anything happen to this collection. We don't know what's going to happen. And so they put 3 to 5 of their staffers on duty 24 hours a day and sealed off 18 rooms because there was another threat about to hit St. Petersburg.
The siege of Leningrad starts in 1941, a year after Vavilov disappears into a gulag. And it lasts for the majority of the entire war, nearly 900 days. The city was cut off on the north by the Finnish army and the south by the German army. And at the time, it was one of the most destructive attacks on a major city in known history. Constant bombing, lack of food and water. People would actually rush into the craters after bombs would drop because water gathered in the craters. That's how they got their water. And through all of this, people are starving to death in Leningrad. Everyone, Russian soldiers, government officials, also the families of the scientists who are protecting, secretly protecting, this massive seed bank. They are putting the location of the bank and the fact that it is full of food, seeds, rice, legumes, in the metaphorical vault. They are not telling anyone. And they are really freaking out, by the way, because Hitler is rumored to be really focused on capturing the seeds in this seed bank as part of his world domination efforts. So it really is a high-stakes mission.
So think of it. You're starving to death. Your family is. You opt for staying in this very powerfully positioned, well-guarded building, and your weight is going down. Your immune system is going down. And as one of the curators said, when someone asked him, was it hard for all of you to try to keep defending the seeds when you could have eaten them to improve your own personal health? He said, well, it was hard to wake up in the morning. It was hard to get on our feet because we were so weak. It was hard to get our clothes on because it was cold. But it was not hard to protect those seeds.
Tell me the story about the pea collection curator.
Alexander Skukin took care of peas, peanuts, and other legumes. And he was one of the ones who died in the first year of the effects of starvation with his seed envelopes in his hand. We know that other people died of diseases carried by rats that they were trying to evict from eating the seeds. A rice collector named Dmitry Ivanov, he died within just a few feet of 1,000 packets of rice that just by boiling up water, cooking the rice could have saved his life.
Overall, 12 scientists died protecting Vavilov's life's work during the siege of Leningrad, most of starvation. As for Vavilov, after a year and a half of eating frozen cabbage and moldy flour, he also died of starvation. He never made it out of the gulag. But the seeds survived, and so did the mission. The Svalbard Seed Vault in Norway is a direct descendant of Vavilov's work. And that building in St. Petersburg is now the Vavilov Institute of Plant Industry. You visited the Seed Vault in St. Petersburg a few years back. What was that like for you?
In my years of doing science, I've only wept twice. And once was in Hawaii when I saw 15 different endangered species, the last individual of many of those species, all sitting on one table in a nursery, and there were none of those species left in the wild. I felt the same way when I saw the wall of photos of those 12 scientists, Russian scientists, who gave up their lives to save those seeds. I was brokenhearted.
What did you see in their faces?
The best that any of us can hope to be on behalf of our fellow creatures.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And let's go to Missouri, where Governor Eric Greitens was indicted on felony invasion of privacy charges yesterday amid allegations of sexual misconduct and blackmail. Greitens denied committing any crime, but he called the situation a, quote, personal mistake. Brian Ellison is host of Statehouse Blend, Missouri, and he's politics reporter for KCUR in Kansas City, and he joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Good to be with you, Magna.
So, first of all, what exactly is Governor Greitens being accused of having done?
The St. Louis Circuit Attorney has indicted him for a Class D felony charge of invasion of privacy. The accusation is that back on March 21st, 2015, that's before he was governor, he took a nude photo without the knowledge and consent of the woman involved, a woman who he has admitted having an extramarital affair with, and subsequently, according to the indictment, transmitted the image contained in the photograph in a way it could be accessed via a computer. Now, we don't have any more details about what exactly that means, but it is that element of it being accessible by computer that makes it a felony charge, punishable by up to 4 years in prison.
Huh. Now, Greitens was booked into a St. Louis jail on Thursday, released on his own recognizance. How has he responded to these charges?
Well, aggressively, I would say. He has said that the charges are politically motivated. The St. Louis Circuit Attorney who brought the information to the grand jury is a former Democratic state representative herself. She's an elected prosecutor, but he called her a, quote, reckless liberal prosecutor in a statement he posted to Facebook. He said she uses her office to score political points and promised that his legal team would be trying to reverse this action right away. They did file a motion to dismiss last night. And in their motion said that this law doesn't apply to the governor's relationship with this woman because it was consensual.
I see. Now, Greitens is a former Navy SEAL, a Rhodes Scholar. He's been governor for just, what, over a year?
Just over a year. Yeah.
So a man of considerable capability and political aspirations. I mean, is he facing, pressure to resign?
He is facing a lot of pressure to resign. As you mentioned, Magna, he has been serving just over a year, and he ran on a campaign of integrity, of draining the swamp. He made lots of reference to the corrupt career politicians in our state capital, Jefferson City. But since his election, he's faced a lot of accusations, not just about this case, but about not being transparent, about taking so-called dark money donations, about using a text messaging app that destroyed the messages, possibly in violation of state sunshine laws. So when this news broke on January 11th, it seemed like for a lot of legislators, like the icing on the cake. And it does indeed seem to be costing him something. Just this morning, the Republican Governors Association issued a statement that said Governor Greitens would not be attending their meetings this weekend and, in fact, has resigned from their executive committee. Having said that, he gives no indication of planning to resign or of backing down.
I see. But as you just mentioned, perhaps he's getting some political pressure from within his own party. I mean, the last 30 seconds that we've got here, Brian, we're in a midterm election year. Could this have any possible spillover effect in Missouri beyond just the governor's office?
Possibly, but it's important to know that Republicans are extremely dominant in the state legislature in Missouri. They have supermajorities in both the House and the Senate. In many districts, they hold sizable majorities. I think it would take some time for this to have sizable political impact on the actual balance of power in the legislature. Even so, it clearly is causing problems such that Republicans are joining in the calls on the governor to resign.
I see. That's Brian Ellison, politics reporter for KCUR in Kansas City. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Magda.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments on Monday in a case that could threaten the funding and power of public sector unions. At issue is whether it's constitutional to require public employees to pay fees to unions for bargaining on their behalf. That's something that nearly half of all states now require. It's a very closely watched case, and joining us to walk us through it is Emily Bazelon. She's staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, it's good to have you back.
Thanks so much.
So first of all, take us through the background of this case. The plaintiff is one Mark Janis, and he did not want to join the union where he works. So what exactly is he arguing?
He is arguing that his teachers' union is collecting dues from him that he doesn't want to pay. Mark Janis is a child support specialist for the state of Illinois. And Illinois has a law that allows public sector unions to collect dues that go to support the collective bargaining that the union does. And Janis doesn't want to pay them.
So he doesn't want to pay the dues, but he would still be represented by the union in collective bargaining efforts?
Exactly. And so years ago in the 70s, when the Supreme Court heard this kind of challenge, the court said that people like Mark Janis do have to pay this kind of union due to prevent what we think of as a free rider problem, right? So Janis is still going to get the benefits of the collective bargaining agreement. And in the 70s, the court said, because we want to prevent this kind of free riding, we're going to let the unions collect these fees, which some people call them fair share fees, like all the people represented by the union are paying their fair share. And other people call them agency fees, which of course makes them sound less attractive.
Right. So the union in this case is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. It's the largest public sector union in Illinois. And I presume they're making the argument that you just laid out, that they need these dues in order to advocate on behalf of their members.
That's right. And the unions also emphasize that the fees they're allowed to collect don't go to all their political activities. They just go to the collective bargaining work that they do. And the other interesting thing about this case is that the law here is being defended by the state of Illinois. So this is a choice that Illinois has made on behalf of its public sector unions. And Illinois is actually arguing to keep its own law.
So then tell me, Emily, how does Republican Governor Bruce Rauner fit into all of this? How is he involved?
Well, he's been fighting with public sector unions in Illinois for a long time. And so he was the original driver behind this case. But actually, his claims have been dismissed. And so at this point, it's really Mark Janis, the plaintiff, who's standing for this idea that people represented by unions shouldn't necessarily pay for the collective bargaining that unions do.
I see. Okay. So you mentioned a minute ago that there's a case, a Supreme Court case from the 1970s. But there's also a more recent one. Justices heard something about this in 2016.
Yes, that's right. So the ruling from the 70s, which is called Abood, has been on the books for a long time. It's allowed states to have these kinds of laws, allowed public sector unions to collect more fees, fair share fees, agency fees, whatever you want to call them, from the people they represent. But the Supreme Court, and in particular Justice Samuel Alito, have been kind of training their sights on this pro-union rule for years now. And it's clear from previous opinions that Justice Alito has written that he is very skeptical of this kind of rule. And the last time the court heard a challenge in 2016, there were four conservative votes for overturning the rule, ruling against the unions. But Justice Scalia had died before the ruling came out. And so the court deadlocked 4-4. Here we have a new case. We have a new justice, Justice Neil Gorsuch, appointed by President Trump. And so the question is how he will break the tie. And it's really not much of a mystery, given Gorsuch's very conservative track record. It looks like he will side with his fellow conservatives.
I see. So then what impact might this case have, broadly speaking? Because obviously, in the private sector, we've been seeing a long-term decline in union membership. In many states, the public sector unions are the strongest unions left. I mean, could this ruling have an impact on these unions nationwide?
Well, that is certainly the fear of the unions. I mean, they see this case as a big threat to their ability to represent their members and also to their political clout, because they are juggernauts, especially for the Democratic Party in a lot of states. We really don't know the answer, because we haven't lived in a world in which states are not allowed to let unions collect these fees. It's possible that the unions will persuade the people they represent to keep paying the fees anyway, and that this free rider problem will be smaller than anticipated. It's a little hard to tell, but it is certainly a major concern of public sector unions right now.
But on the other hand, as you just emphasized, there are states in which members do not have to pay their dues.
That is true. Yeah. And some of those are right-to-work states. Those are states in which the public sector unions are much less powerful and public sector employees tend to have worse benefits and pay packages.
Interesting. Well, Emily Bazelon, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Contaminated drinking water has been a major problem for some U.S. cities. Of course, there's Flint, Michigan. And the problem has also plagued some indigenous communities in Canada. Some of them have been without safe water for years. The problem hits remote communities and those close to the U.S. border. The Canadian government is making efforts to improve water infrastructure on reservations. And Elizabeth Miller of Great Lakes Today has our story.
The Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve in Ontario is just 70 miles from Buffalo, New York. With about 27,000 members and half living on the reserve, Six Nations is the largest of Canada's Indigenous communities. On a recent visit, I get a tour of the water treatment plant.
Down here, I have the raw water, the Grand River source. We have a bunch of bar screens.
Wes Hill operates the $41 million plant, which was built in 2013. It's a big step up from the old plant. It quadrupled the amount of treated water and has enough capacity for the whole Six Nations community. But some residents use wells for their water. Hill grew up in Six Nations. He remembers his family buying water because their private well was unsafe.
We were getting a water truck to truck water out to our cisterns because our wells were contaminated. Maybe every 2 weeks we were getting a load of water, which was like $80 a load, so it was quite expensive to get treated water out here.
Having a treatment plant has made Six Nations a leader on water safety. But Six Nations still has a boil water advisory for residents who rely on wells. It's been in place for nearly 20 years. And there's another big problem. Water from the plant only reaches 9% of the community. So a lot of folks continue to have to drive to a truck fill station in the center of town to fill up cisterns or pay to have water delivered. Six Nations Public Works Director Michael Montour says it will cost about $200 million to connect all homes on the reserve to the plant. The plan is to chip away at that number with small projects, like piping water to one or two schools.
It's a big, big task to get $200 million, so we've kind of cut it down to this first phase.
Canada's government has long recognized the water problems in its First Nations communities. There are currently 91 long-term drinking water advisories across the country designed to protect residents from bacteria and other harmful contaminants. In some communities, the Canadian government warns residents not to use the water at all, even for washing up. Canada has pledged $1.8 billion to resolve the problem. Lizanne Baldeck is Director of Regional Support Services for Indigenous Services Canada.
We would like to see as fast as possible, and we are committed to supporting First Nation as quickly as possible resolve these issues, recognizing that infrastructure does take some time to be implemented.
Baldeck says the goal is to remove all advisories by 2021, in addition to repairing and replacing water treatment facilities. And Six Nations probably won't get that $200 million anytime soon. The problem across Canada is so enormous. Some First Nations don't even have a water treatment plant, so they're a higher priority for government funding, says Michael Montour.
The fact that us as the largest First Nation in Canada have these conditions on reserve, I can't imagine what these what the more northern and remote First Nations have to deal with.
There is a new project that may shed some light on water quality issues in Six Nations. It's led by Don Martin Hill, Indigenous Studies professor at McMaster University and resident of the Six Nations Reserve. The project will figure out what contaminates water sources here and look at the health impacts of water quality in the community.
I think Americans and Canadians are now going to understand in the very short, near future why they shouldn't be taking water for granted, because it is a precious resource. It's blue gold.
The project has funding for 3 years, and Martin Hill said she's already received requests for help from other Indigenous communities. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
At the Olympics, Canada's men's hockey team lost to Germany in the semifinals today after that nail-biting loss to the Americans on the women's side. And neither the men's nor the women's Canadian curling teams won medals. Canadian Camille DeSumma tweeted, "Our country's at the brink of disaster. What's going on here in Canada?" Meanwhile, Canada does have 27 medals, second to Norway, and the U.S. only has 21, fourth place. Now, in curling, the U.S. faces Sweden tomorrow in the gold medal game, so that'll be a great one to watch. It is the final weekend of the Olympics, and the outside events, well, the forecast for today in Pyeongchang calls for sunshine and a high in the mid-40s. It is not going to snow, and that's where our next guest comes in. Joe Vanderkellen is president of SMI Snowmakers, based in Midland, Michigan. They've been making much of the snow for the events at the Olympics this year. Joe, how much of the snow for these Olympics has been machine-made?
You know, if you've been watching on TV at all, you can see that there's not a lot of natural snow around there. So depending on which venue it is, we estimate between 90 and 98% of the snow that's there has been machine-made and produced in advance of the games.
And does fake snow or machine-made snow feel different than real snow?
Yeah, please don't use the term fake snow. It's definitely real snow, and it's like 1 week or 2 week old natural snow. And in terms of its shape and how it's been formed, natural snow can typically take between 2 hours to say 2 days to form, and it would have like those dendritic arm structures and be very low density, whereas the machine-made snow, we produce water droplets through the equipment, create ice seeds, and we only have like 3 to 15 seconds to freeze them. So it's more like a BB shape or a grapple, and it doesn't have the arms. So we like to say machine-made snow is like 1 week or 2 week old natural snow that's been sitting there and takes a while to go into a different grain size and actually can be become a better surface once it's tilled for the athletes.
How long does it take to make the amount of snow you need to make for the Olympics?
Well, take the Jonsson Alpine venue. We've had people over there since early November, and they pretty much made snow from November 15th till about January 10th most of the days. It was cold. And so they converted around 200 million gallons of water into snow during that time. And around January 10th is when we turned the venue over to the FIS IOC.
So I've been skiing on mountains that make their own snow, and you see these huge booms on the side of the slopes that I've never seen them actually turned on, but I've seen them when they're at rest. Has snowmaking changed over the years? Is the technology different than it used to be?
Yes, it's definitely changed a lot in the last 20 years. Our use of energy is much more efficient. Our ability to nucleate or ice seed the water droplets is greatly improved. The energy usage is way down, and the equipment's a lot easier to use as well. So the end result for the mountain resorts around the world is they're making a lot more snow, a lot more efficiently, at a lot warmer temperatures for a lot less money.
What have been some of the challenges this year at the Olympics? Is there a particular course that has been difficult to keep covered?
No, it's been a fairly routine snowmaking year because it's been a little bit colder and drier than normal there. But the Alpine venue, which is where the men's and women's downhill and combined has been, and you've seen the women there the last couple of days, it's a very steep, very rocky, very rugged terrain that has high winds. So that's probably been the most challenging venue just because of the vertical involved and the terrain that's there. But they're using a fully automated snowmaking system controlled by our Smart Snow software. So it's fairly automated and fairly routine to make that snow now because they have a very new and modern system that's been built in the last couple years.
Do you put a line in your contract for snowmaking that says, you know, if it snows several feet and you don't need us, this is what happens?
No, not really. You know, actually, the people that prepare the course, if there's any natural snow starting about mid-January till when the games start in early to mid-February, they'll actually push the natural snow off. The racers like a very hard surface that minimizes rutting. So that between the 40 and 60 competitors that might race, they're trying to keep that surface as consistent as they can as they carve those gates and those corners. So they really like a very hard surface, and they don't like natural snow at all.
That's Joe Vanderkellen, who is president of SMI Snowmakers, talking about the snow his company has been making for the Olympics in South Korea. Joe, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be on with you, and I'd encourage all your listeners to go outside and slide around and have some fun on the snow.
Even if it's natural snow.
Nothing wrong with a 2 or 3 foot powder day or with a good machine-groomed surface.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is back on Monday. It's Here and Now.